Dave Fanning on 2FM.
Now, I want to talk with Lucy Easthope. She's a woman whose job is to live with disaster every day. When a plane crashes, a bomb explodes, or a city floods, or a pandemic begins, she's the one they call. As one of the leading experts on disaster, she's been at the centre of the most seismic events of the past few decades, advising on everything from the 2004 tsunami to the Salisbury poisonings, the Grenfell fire, and the COVID-19 pandemic. She's travelled across the world to see the very worst that people have to face and the very best of humanity, even in the most extreme situations. She takes us behind the police tape to scenes of destruction and chaos, introducing us to victims and their families, but also to the often kind of frenzied responses in government briefing rooms and bunkers. Well, Lucy has written it all down in When the Dust Settles, Stories of Love, Loss and Hope from an Expert in Disaster. And Lucy Easthope is with us now. So welcome to the programme, Lucy. Lucy, let's go back to Hillsborough in April 1989. Even though you had been involved with work experience with your uncle and aunt, who were coroners long before that, there's something about Hillsborough that will stay with the people of your town, Liverpool, for generations.
Absolutely. And that was an obvious place for the book to start. And I was a child in the class, and I had school friends at the match. And so the game was on the Saturday, and then my classmates were in on the Monday, and very, very distressed. And that really focused me in on the pain that disaster causes. And it was from there, really.
OK, but that's the disaster from a few days later. I'm talking about the fact that the trauma was continued and continued right through, decades, because of A, the South Yorkshire Police and basically the lies they told, and then B, the stories they fed at the tabloids, and then all coroners' requests. So this is one that stayed with you forever because of no proper, closure.
Yeah. Although one theme I really wanted to draw out with all of the stories that I tell is just how long all of them take. You know, disaster pain tends to be very, very traumatic with no clear end point. There's a lot of better days and then ebbs and flows and goes back to being very painful. So really, I haven't really seen any sense of closure in my disaster work. And one of the things about my work is I do go back and I do see places many years later. And you're absolutely right. These things are multi-generational trauma.
Yeah, exactly, indeed. By the way, that's the Hillsborough disaster. Obviously, Liverpool playing Nottingham Forest in an FA Cup semi-final, and 97 people killed and many injured. Just from your point of view, the work experience, your uncle and your aunt, as a kid, was it more or less like a student that you were working in a coroner's place?
Yeah, and they were hugely, hugely important to my interest, really. So coroners are High Court judge-level judges who come up with a classification of how and when and who has died, and also what's called a prevention of future deaths report, so things that society can do to make itself safer. So that was really where I was spending my summer holidays, and they were hugely influential on me.
And would it be fair to say then that because of that, you've never really been afraid of the dead? And I use the word afraid, and that most people are.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, and I think something that people have really picked up from the book is just the sense of being at ease, I suppose. I don't think it's that unusual. I think you see it in other professions as well, like those that work in hospitals and forensics. But I think it's helped me a lot because it means that I get past perhaps an initial fear, and you look at what needs to happen next, and that's been a huge part of my work.
And there's so much in the small detail. For instance, when you talk about viewing rooms for corpses and the smell of coffee, or the assault on the nasal passages of decomposing bodies, or the particular cleaning fluid that's used. And you might be out for a night at a concert and you go into the ladies' loo and suddenly it brings you right back because of that. Just one of those. The smell of coffee. What exactly is that about?
Yeah, so when I started out, I'm certainly thinking it's not done as much now, but we used to have very large canisters of coffee, instant coffee, about the mortuary for two reasons. One, it would absorb the smell, and the other thing was, which I think is quite horrific when you think about it, was that often cosmetology chemicals were designed really only for Caucasian white skin. So the embalmers used to slightly alter the colour using a little bit of instant coffee, and it's been great in recent years to see that challenged, and there's a much more broad range of cosmetology makeup now. So yeah, coffee is something that I'm always reminded by.
And also your coping mechanism for the stuff that I mentioned at the very, very beginning, just before we started talking to you, which is, all to do with, unpicking what you see and then looking at it saying, I never shy away from what I see. It's very important. I mean, like even the careful collation and storing of body parts, there are certain standards and you have to make sure that you're, you know, fully on your game.
And I think that's been a huge comfort, actually, yeah, for people to read, that there are people who care about this, you know, that much and will go to that effort. And, you know, you are seeing it now in places like Ukraine. There's always people who come afterwards. And I think that's been something I've been really overwhelmed by the reaction, because this isn't just my story. It's lots of people's stories who work afterwards, you know, after the Big Bang, and people have moved on.
Yeah, they're working afterwards. I mean, like, while there were people sort of marching in London, like, you know, with banners saying stop the war and everything else in terms of Iraq, you would have been elsewhere tracking down coffins and body bags and all that, weren't you?
Yeah, so we were commissioned for the private firm that I was working for at the time to build the mortuary in case of war. Mm. And then it became a reality. And that was, that sort of stayed with me, I think, really, that sort of, you know, preparing for people who hadn't died yet was pretty terrible, really.
And again, a detail in terms of the bombings in London and the tubes, well, three on the tube and one on the bus. And you were on the underground at the time, obviously, like, no warning. And this happens in 2005. And one of the things you say, you have to find a hawk. And the reason to find a hawk is, it seriously, to scare off scavenging pigeons who'll steal bits of bones for their nests.
I use that story to illustrate all those little bits of work that we're doing. And, you know, sort of open the door to the detail that we're going to at the scene. And also to make the link between my own life experience, which was that I'd learnt that about the importance of scaring the pigeons and the seagulls away, working here, but supporting teams going out to 9/11 at Ground Zero. And this was the thing about, you know, the bank of knowledge that you were starting to build up from disaster to disaster, really.
Well, then let's take a look at that, about what you really do, because, you know, you deal with the aftershocks of a catastrophe, and you plan for that as well. Just tell me about that. You know, the emergency planning is an awful lot about learning from what happened, isn't it?
It's a constant cycle. We call it iterative. So we plan for something that might happen using a big register of risks. Then if it happens, we reach for our plan. And then if things deviate and we need to learn again, we alter the plan. And you know, it can be a bit soul destroying, but it also can be very positive. And I've got a specialism in the aftermath. So I'm very interested in planning for longer and looking at what people need, perhaps into the 2 and 5 year point, as well as just the initial aftermath.
So therefore, like, you know, if paramedics and firefighters and forensics and all the rest are kind of lauded, if you like, you do all yours behind closed doors. In fact, I quote, you're a Cinderella service sweeping up below stairs.
Absolutely. And it was a lovely chance, actually, to bring that to the fore a bit. You know, there are thousands of emergency planners all around the world, and it was a lovely, lovely chance to be able to write about them. And also the work that goes into being one, you know, the studying and the training that's done constantly.
Yeah, indeed. By the way, I'm speaking to Lucy Easthorpe about her book, which is called When the Dust Settles, Stories of Love, Loss and Hope from an Expert in Disaster. Now, on the subject of disaster, has it changed in terms of the reaction from real concern, as might have been many years ago, though you can, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, to kind of optics? In other words, like, kind of whatever happened here was really bad. How would the Prime Minister look?
Oh, that's a big theme for me, and something I am very worried about. And certainly the last few years in England, I think that had become a real concern about how we possibly kind of nudged or moved communities to think about disaster. I think because of my background, I'm very keen that we're very honest with communities, we're very upfront, and sometimes that's very difficult and painful honesty, including being very detailed about what's happened. And I'm always a little suspicious, I think, when we rush to force communities down a particular road and tell them how they're supposed to be feeling about something. So it had become very, very concerning, and that's something I do address with some trepidation, because it is a controversial point.
Do you know, if I said that, you know, merely, that what you are merely, and really just take out that word merely, I'm sure you'd say, a giant elastoplast for the worst that might happen. That's a huge thing to be.
Yes, and I think certainly the newer to the profession and younger to the profession have felt a huge burden, and particularly as we feel like we're just kind of going from one crisis to the next. And it's been very difficult, I think, when the public don't know you're there. You're very vulnerable to things like austerity and a cut in resources. So it is a huge burden sometimes.
And you obviously write emergency plans for the government as well as for all sorts of organisations. Do you put a lot of recommendations in there with red flags saying, seriously, we need to do this next time?
So my plans are very, very simple. When I brief, I'm known for being very firm, very urgent, very clear. Everything's delivered with a big smile on my face, but pretty terrifying if you're in a briefing from me. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, pretty terrifying in a briefing from you. But when you arrive at a scene, and I mean, it's really like just the worst you could possibly imagine, because 5 minutes before that, it was probably perfect. And you just get there as quick as you can. And it's just mayhem. And you're not police, as I say, you're not forensic. And you're not a man. Is stuff stacked against you that you have to, if you like, perfect your swagger?
Absolutely. And that was something I really wanted to draw out. It has been very difficult. You know, I don't have a title like coroner or secretary of state or any of those things. And so you do have to negotiate what you're doing there and work your way in. And I tend to arrive quite a little bit later, so I'm not in the way of the first responders. And then generally what happens is people remember what I did on the last disaster. And I think one thing you get a real sense of in the book is just how many things befall us constantly. And so if we're not actually responding, we're doing exercises. And we're quite a tight-knit community. And then you're welcomed in. But it's been very hard. And being a woman has been a huge part of my story.
Well, like, there was a plane crash at an air show. 11 people died when the plane, you know, if only it had crashed in a field, but no, it crashed into people. And there's some of your details, like the metal with fusing with whatever happens to be there, the body parts, the shoes, the wads of clothes, or cloth, I should say, the gauze, the tubing floating on the surface of a large puddle. These things all come to you saying, like, you know, we'll have to examine all this stuff and check it out. Is that it as well? Yeah.
And it was really important to me, I think, that I conveyed the overwhelming sense of it. You know, the fact that it doesn't descend into chaos, the fact that commanders do follow a plan and are able to bring some sort of order to it is a miracle in itself. You know, so one of the reasons for being as clear about what you're actually turning up to as I was so that you get some kind of atmospheric sense. So then you understand why the plan is important and why the planners are important. But yeah, I mean, that scene was particularly overwhelming. And then I describe other places. You know, one place which really challenges my senses is whenever I go to a place where we've taken what are called the personal effects.
Yeah.
So the items from the body and the scene, things like pens, shoes, clothes, toys. And that really challenges your senses. You just can't believe you're seeing that.
Well, when you mentioned that, the bombings in London in 2005, and you mentioned, I think it was it a salad or a lunch in a box? And there was also an unfinished, just about finished, with new annotations being made before the bombs went off for somebody's thesis in a college.
You know, a colleague very early on said to me, the mortuary is hard and working with families is hard, but the hardest thing of all will be the personal effects. And they are such a window into somebody's life at that point. And that's probably my proudest work, is that throughout my career, beginning at the start of it, I've always tried to protect those items. If we lose them at the scene or they go to landfill, we can't get them back. We can't give them to the families. So that's something we now have very early on in the plan. And I'm very, very proud of that.
For you personally, Lucy, what's the hardest part? I mean, you do say one of the hardest parts of working in a disaster area is going home, and fear is a dark genie. It's not easy to put back, and it's bottled, and all these kind of things. So, like, every disaster seems to be seared into your brain, because you say that in the book, and you say also that it's nudged and shaped every aspect of your life and your very self. Do you turn off?
I do work very hard to turn off. I think, like many of my colleagues, we're very interested in disaster. We don't always object to being disturbed by it. You know, we'll talk long into the night. We run a disaster movie club now between us. We are very, very focused on our work. But once I had my two small children and I've got a husband, I did realise that I would have to make sure that there's room for other things as well. So it's been it's an important part of my life to turn off. And in fact, one of the key themes in the book is exploring this line, the hardest part of working in disaster is going home. And that I've had a huge overwhelming outpouring from the response community, you know, policing and fire and forensics, just saying they totally get that, and that the book has helped them talk to their family about what they've seen and why they've been keeping it quiet. And that's a lovely response to have had.
Indeed. When the Dust Settles, by the way, is what it's called. Stories of love, loss and hope from an expert in disaster. And Lucy Easthope is who we're talking to. And Lucy, like, we're talking nuclear incidents, food shortages, volcanoes, tsunamis, fuel shortages, train crashes, plane crashes, pandemics, chemical attacks, etc. Did you learn anything much, and were you involved in anything to do with the Oklahoma City, city bombing in 95?
That was just a little bit before my time, yeah. But I do make reference to it because some of the psychologists who mentored me had come. So I started, you know, my career started in the start of the 2000s, and they had come from that. And so you sort of see that this field builds on the events that have gone before it, and that many of my American colleagues that had a huge totemic effect on them. Yeah. So I mentioned that very briefly. Very similar to the way that I also talk about being very much mentored and schooled by the bereaved and the families of the 1980s and 90s disasters here in England, which became known as the Decade of Disasters. So we're always, I think, building on those events that went before.
And in, for instance, Grenfell, I mean, when you are there for that, it's not your job to necessarily, like, see the actual kind of, you know, I don't know, the problem or such, but do you ever find things that you would have to say to the police or the forensics or whatever, saying, hold on a second, I know what happened here, or you've missed this bit?
Well, I think one of the things that I raise throughout is this role that we call, it's actually enshrined in the New Zealand disaster guidance, which is called playing the wild card, which is making space for somebody to say, point out the problems. Yeah. And that was very difficult to do at Grenfell, but, you know, I go into some of that in the book. But that's really my role, and it's still my role. I'm doing it for many local authorities at the moment in relation to the Ukraine situation, and making sure that the policies and approaches to the new refugees are safe. So, you know, I really protect the idea that when you put in a plan, you also put in people like me who will look at that with you and see whether it's working.
So the days you're working at the moment, would they involve some kind of talk about solution to the Ukraine problem?
Well, absolutely. And we always say that in disaster management, we're always two seasons ahead. We're like a Paris fashion house. So we're already in winter and spring of next year. And these are very tough times for the country. And so some of the things, you know, we are looking at with local authorities at the moment is how do we make the Ukraine refugee schemes work? We're also looking at many other things. The National Risk Register will be coming out, and that will include things like the risk of more flooding and the risk of flu pandemic. And for my work at the moment, there's a lot of lessons that have come in. They come in constantly from Grenfell and Manchester inquiries. So we're training all over again. So it's a very, very busy and interesting time in disaster planning.
And also, like, you know, the work of the UK disaster response people. I mean, like, you know, you run investigations, you build mortuaries, you oversee identification, burials, personal effects, as you say, repatriations and all the rest. And also what comes later. The personal effects things again. Does this, like, I mean, you yourself have a box of personal effects, don't you, about something that happened in your life?
Yeah, so it really brought it home to me, you know, and I was running parallel, really. I was working on projects with people like big police forces about how they wanted to return personal effects to a bereaved family. And throughout sort of probably the busiest point of my career, really, I was also trying to have children. And I had several, five pregnancy losses. And so I make the link there because you've got that sort of some of the similar emotions around wanting to show that the person has existed, you know, and keeping the memory boxes. So that's weaved into the story as well.
It is. And you mentioned COVID-19 and the most sort of, I don't know, the most diligently planned for risk in British history. It was it?
Absolutely. Some form of pandemic. We tended to plan more for flu, but some form of pandemic was on our risk register as the highest and most likely risk, and we exercised and trained for it constantly. But there were a few challenges with that, as I'm sure people are very aware. You know, we went into it in quite a weakened position, so it wasn't an easy disaster to respond to, and never would it have been. It's absolutely, you know, globally huge on paper, but now, I think one of the difficulties for us is to pick ourselves up very quickly in disaster planning because there are more threats around the corner.
Finally, Lucy, you know, your professional experience, as you say, has taught you the value of a horizon to swim towards, the importance of trying to build something afterwards, if you like. So, advice, be painfully honest about the bumps ahead, but there has to be a purpose, a future, a bluer sky, as you call it.
Absolutely, and that's hugely important to me. And I thank, you know, all of the disaster communities that have taught me about those littler moments of hope and solace that come amongst, you know, very difficult times. And that's one of the reasons why my job is so privileged and so enjoyable, yeah. is I do get to see those moments.
And there are funny bits in the book actually as well, believe it or not. There are. There really are. Anyway, when the dust settles, Lucy Easthope, stories of love, loss, and hope from an expert in disaster. It is. So, Lucy, thank you very much indeed for talking with us on the programme today.
Thank you. Dave Fanning on 2FM.